think it was like within scenes that remained in the film. It just was were longer scenes with more improvisations within the scenes that exist in the film.
But she did say there's lots of great stuff that we didn't use, you know, just delicious stuff.
I think she, yeah, when I first saw her, since I saw the film, she sat me down and was like, here's why I had to cut this, here's why I had to cut this.
Oh, really?
As if I was going to have any sort of issue with it. And I was like, the movie's fantastic. I'm so proud, you know? It's like, I just love her attitude, like, her talking to me, like, just an actor she worked with. When in reality, she's one of my all-time heroes and has cut all of my favorite movies. And I was like, you know, in my head, I go, whatever decisions you and Martin Scorsese make are the right decisions. I'm glad I just saw the final cut of the film, because I have complete faith that what they ended up with was what they felt was best.
It was really different. The first screen that you introduced me at the West Side Pavilion, mm-hmm. you know how critics are, they're a little restrained, mm-hmm. you know. They tend not to be as emotive, not as emotional.
Right, like audibly during a...
Yeah, that's not the big laugh. But when I saw it with a kind of a, still an interested crowd, but more of a mixed crowd, at the Sherry Lansing on the lot, lots of laughter. And I realized what was going on.
So, right.
I mean, I knew what I was feeling for the first thing. The interested crowd, they were like really, really having fun. Which I had been at the Zig Show, right?
Yeah, that was a great... Were you at that screening, or no?
No, I worked literally two buildings from that, and I took a picture of it.
Oh, cool. Yeah, I mean, that screening was amazing. And Leo and I sat in and sat through the screening. And
the whole thing,
yeah. It was great to watch lots of, especially New Yorkers, people, a lot of people that weren't in the show business, you know. And the movie plays... part of the reason why I love it is it plays, yeah, it's very emotive. The audible response from the audience, whether it's laughter or shock or appall, is very audibly resonant in the crowd. You know, watching every screening I've been in, the lewd fight, Lemon Lewd's fight sequence gets an applause after. Every screening.
Oh, you mean the
kitchen
phone.
And then choking, and then and then when Leo settles on the couch, when it's the audience breathes for the first time in the past 10 minutes, and then every screening I've been in, there's been a round of applause. Uh-huh. I've never worked with Martin Scorsese before, but I've never been to a film where the same sequence gets a round of applause in every screening. You know, that's pretty amazing.
The punch is the Popeye spinach thing.
That's when people go crazy, and then it's just such a mad. The scene is so mad. It's so out of control. And then the Donnie falling on the table and choking, and Jordan, the ham getting spit in his face, and then he finally lays down on the couch, he's able to rest, and the audience, I think, feels like they're able to rest for the first time in the last 10 minutes, you know? And it's just such a beautifully cut scene by Thelma.
What's the kind of glass that they use when they wanted to splatter? It's called...
It's just breakaway glass.
Breakaway glass.
Yeah. And it doesn't hurt. It's just great. Yeah. Do you guys want anything? I'm gonna have an iced coffee, please. I would love it.
Get the mozzarella and the pomodoro.
Sure. I don't know. The gem lettuce Caesar. Diet Coke.
Actually, I'm gonna switch mine to Diet Coke also.
Okay, sure.
It's inspired by your order. I got bit by my friend's dog the other day.
What happened?
It's a rescue dog. Yeah, he was on my lap for 20 minutes. Fine, I was massaging his neck, all good.
Doberman?
No, it was a Brussels Griffon. But it was an abused dog, and like all of a sudden, it was like 20 minutes. I was grabbing him. I know him well, nicest time, petting him, everything. Out of nowhere, just chomps down on my finger. It's so crazy.
Did you get an antibiotic shot?
No, I got called like hydrogen peroxide and all that stuff.
Okay. Just be on the safe side.
Yeah. Well, if I have no finger next time I see you, then you'll understand why. We'll have hashed it out ahead of time.
Everything that you have a hand in writing, and I assume a lot of the comedies, it's your personality, it's your decisions, your choices. There's snap and real smart edge going on in everything. You know, it's never congenial, which is why it's great. It's why it's good. 21 Jump Street, I'm really surprised that I like that a lot more than I expected.
That's the idea of that film, is that you're not supposed to like it. And you, if it was, the expectations are so low,
yeah,
that I figured if it's a decent movie, people will think I'm really smart, because it's a movie that should be terrible.
Well, the trailer set it up pretty well, the attitude.
Well, what we did was, we were like, we just were incredibly self-aware of how lazy and unoriginal it is to recycle a TV show into a film, especially one that wasn't, you know, it's not like we were recycling The Sopranos 20 years later. It wasn't some epic show. It was a poppy, you know, ridiculous 80s TV show. And so I think self-awareness is what made that movie work at all. And then we made a second one, and we just finished. And the idea of that one in the same scene where the cop says in the first one, where he goes, you know, it's lazy, they recycle old programs from the 80s. And this one we go, second missions are always worse and more expensive than first missions. And so the idea is that sequels are always bigger and shittier than the first one. You're just trying to recapture some magic that's impossible to recapture. And so that's kind of making fun of ourselves in the film. But, you know,
same
filmmakers who work great. And for me, I just love the idea that I got to make two really heavy movies. I got to make Wolf of Wall Street, which is a dark film to be a part of, and live in that for a while, even though there's a lot of humor in it. It's very dark humor. And a movie called True Story right after. So I made two really dark films in a row, and then I really cathartically wanted to go make, like, a silly, funny movie. And so I feel really lucky that I get the opportunity to exercise different parts of myself and play all different types of characters for really different filmmakers. You know, Bennett could not be more different than Scorsese, who could not be more different than Tarantino, who could not be more different than Phil and Chris, who could not be more different than Greg Mottola. Like, they're all very, you know, they are just such different people and different artists that it's like, I really love getting to learn from all these different people, you know?
Between Bennett Miller and who would you say is more spontaneous, more open to, you know, an idea that just pops up, or are they both the same? What's that like?
Both Bennett and Scorsese are incredibly open to collaboration, you know? But what I was really surprised by Martin Scorsese was the amount of improvisation he not only allowed but encouraged, you know. Bennett wasn't some super rigid director where you couldn't, any idea was welcome and talked about and just collaborated on. But thank you. Just Diet Coke, yeah. Thank you. But Moneyball had a lot more specifics. Like, I had to memorize tons and tons of stats and tons of things in the trade scene. Although, you know, like, my favorite scene, or one of my favorites in that film, is like the Rincon trade, where, like, you know, I go like that, and it's like that moment where Brad and I are doing the big training sequence that we're not supposed to do. Like, it's so many specific names and numbers and things like that. So what I learned from Bennett the most, and what he taught me more than any filmmaker I've worked with, was it's not what you're saying. You could be saying anything, and you're getting across something totally different. You are acting out emotions and things that are not in the words that you're saying at all. Because I was mostly saying numbers and stats, but I had to express a lot of other emotions through that. And with Scorsese, it was very much open to find new elements of things and explore different parts of your character. You know, he says, you know, the story is not really that important to him. You know, I don't want to quote him, but, you know, it's, he was far more concerned with making a movie about interesting characters and why they did these things than a very specific story to follow. And I found that amazing, and I think that's a great lesson. But if I hadn't worked with Bennett, I don't think I would. My favorite scene I've ever shot in a movie was in Wolf of Wall Street, which is the sushi scene where he's wearing a wire. And
oh, yeah, I know.
Yeah, the note scene. And so we're having to say a million, Leo and I were saying, having to say a million things to one another when we can't say a word of what we actually mean because he's wearing a wire. And if I hadn't worked with Bennett, I don't think I would have had that lesson ingrained in me to bring to that scene.
About subjects.
About what you're not saying. About it has nothing to do with what you're saying.
Yeah.
So I watched that scene. I've never been so proud of a piece of work that I've done or anything because it's the end of our friendship. It's the end of our business. It's a possible betrayal. It's the end of the lifestyle we've built. It's the end of everything.
One decent moment, though, for Jordan Belfort. I thought this is decent.
Right.
Do that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. And then, but you can't say any of the feelings. And so it's all Leo and I having to have this conversation while talking about small talk.
Right.
You know? And I found that the biggest challenge and something that was a lesson I learned from Bennett the most bringing into that scene.
There's three critics right now that are it's like 92% or like that right now. But there's like three critics. You're never going to get a uniform, you know. You read most of your reviews, have you been doing it all along? Or do you not read?
I've stopped now.
Why?
Because
they're ecstatic.
It's a very slippery slope. Because here's the thing. So I read all the reviews for Moneyball. Okay? And I got really happy. I let it affect how I felt about the movie and the performance.
Mm-hmm.
Even though separately I was just so blissed with the movie itself and the performance itself and happy and proud and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the reviews came out and they were great, it really made me feel really good. And then this film is coming out, you know? And I don't read them for the comedy films because those films are for, you know, I strictly care if people laugh or they don't when I make a broad comedy. I don't really care about going too deep into it, you know? But with something like this that I put so much love into, so much, I put everything I had into this performance and this part, and it was an amazing experience. I didn't want, let's say someone didn't like it, I don't want that to affect how I feel about getting to work with Martin Scorsese and getting to give something that I'm so proud of. I'm scared if I read something bad, it might make me think lesser of the experience or something, you know?
Whose idea was the teeth? Because Danny Forrest looks like that, or?
I guess in the book it said that one of the characters had fake teeth, and then we changed the name and kind of took things from a few different characters. But
wait, in Jordan's book, he was describing Danny or one of the characters having a false set of
phosphorescent
All right.
teeth, and that was in Terry's screenplay.
Okay.
So that was already in the screenplay that Donnie would have. And Sandy Powell, so amazing, the costume designer in this film. She needs no accolades from me. She's a legend, you know. But I've never been so collaborative with a costume designer before, and it was the greatest experience because Donnie is such an eccentric, bizarre character. It was just really.
I love the purple violet socks, the yellow. Really,
I mean,
nice stuff.
She really is brilliant, and.
Yeah.
We talked a lot about Donnie trying to look waspier and more upper crust than he actually was. And so the teeth were like, they're literally veneers. And so we wanted everything to be a veneer. We wanted the sweaters around his neck and his ties to match his socks. And there's this line that was improvised in the scene with on the roof John Barenthal, Brad, the character of Brad, we're fighting, he takes out the gun, and he goes, I don't give a fuck about your gun, and I go, you know what, another thing, you dress like shit, and I can hear Marty laughing from the monitors, because the idea that Donnie, that just means that Donnie thinks that he dresses incredibly well, and is able to pass judgment on the way that someone else's taste, and I just thought that was really interesting that this person would have a really snooty attitude about how well put together he was when he looked so ridiculous. You know, I just thought that was really a fun thing to play with. And it's what it is. It's all these guys think the world of themselves. They have no self-doubt in any way.
That's,
you know?
That's the common...
They feel they deserve to be anywhere they are.
Right.
And I just... That idea was really interesting to me throughout, you know? Or Donnie thinking that people want to sleep with him or that, you know what I mean? It's like, he's so unaware, you know? He's so unaware of what the reality is.
It's so bizarre to read the, particularly the British critics, they completely accept and are completely running with, this is, it's obviously a specific story that happened, but it's also metaphor for the flamboyance, the... third flamboyance is 1%, and they're really eloquent on it. And yet you go here, there's like three critics that are basically scold. They feel that it, in a way it almost gets a little past because it's more entertaining than it is ethical, moralistic. And I've tried to say that I just feel that it's this balancing act of being moralistic and ethical. Clearly, since Jeff's view as well, that the but at the same time being very uproarious. Circus-like bacchanalian. How do you address that when people say it doesn't seem to be as ethical or moralistic as it should be?
Look, I love this idea that some people look at it. I don't understand how. So I love hearing the idea from people that they think it's glorifying. I think that is so absurd that someone would believe that. I watch this movie and I go, I despise these people and don't want to live any sort of life 1,000 miles close to where. You know? And not even being judgmental, it just looks horrible to me. It just, and maybe because I played the character and I had to think about where they're coming from and everything, but to me, all I can say is when I saw Goodfellas, I saw movies when I was really young. My parents, for better or for worse, separated art from actual behavior and allowed me to watch whatever films I want, you know, because I love films. And so I saw Goodfellas, which is my all-time favorite movie, when I was 9 years old. And probably when I was like 9 or 10 years old, I probably thought, wow, it'd be pretty cool to be a gangster, you know? These guys are cool, they're shot in slow motion to Rolling Stone songs, and they are made to look cool. But then as Terry Winter and I talk about it a lot, we had this conversation last night for a long time about, have you not seen Goodfellas till the end of the movie? Everyone either kills each other or you end up in witness protection eating egg noodles and ketchup is the idea, you know? And so, also, another huge movie for me, a huge influence, was Kids, the Larry Clark film. I saw that when I was about 94, so I was about 11 years old, 12 years old. That's a very graphic movie for someone that age to see. But at that time, I was a skateboarder. I loved skating. At that time, I watched Kids and go, I want to be a New York skater skating at Washington Square Park. There's hip-hop music playing in the background, and there's girls around, and I skate, they look cool, they're shot in slow motion, whatever it is. And I completely ignored the AIDS plot of the film Kids, which is at the end of the film that everyone has AIDS, and it's a cautionary tale. That's what the movie really is. And so I think it's where you're at when you see something. To me, if you're an adult and you watch this movie and think it's glorifying scamming people out of money and living in excess, I really think you're misunderstanding the point of it. I think you are just clearly just did not get it.
Even when Marty throws in an extra emphatic point, like the moment when Leo narrates,
killed himself.
Anyway,
it's my favorite. But that's my favorite moment in the whole film. That is hands down. I think the whole movie comes from that.
Yeah.
Where it's unapologetic. You know, it's unapologetic. This is the way these guys work. They did it. If it were you or I, and we were describing someone we knew who had killed themselves, we would, you know, take time to empathize and show grief and show the proper amount of respect to that situation. But the way Jordan Belfort described it is, he killed himself anyway, and then he's on to the next thing, you know. But that's who this person is. It's not saying go be this person. That's how this guy. That's why it's an interesting story to tell, because he's an interesting left of center, different kind of person than most people, you know. But I think truly the tone of the movie comes from that moment. And I said that to Terry, and I had a long conversation about that as well, because I think that's one of the most, that sets the tone for what the movie is. It's funny, it's unapologetic, and it's dark. You know? And
plus the fighting over the kids scene. I mean, there's so many things that are just
right. Right, or like Donnie, you know, the thing I enjoy the most is Donnie's entrance into the film. Because the entrance scene where he comes into Jordan, people don't laugh. Because it's not funny, it's just uncomfortable and invasive. Where he's like, how much money do you make and all this stuff. And then, thank you so much. Then you go into the phone booth and Jordan starts narrating what he thinks of Donnie, and then you start to laugh, like, oh, his white teeth and all this stuff, and you see me on the phone. And then we go in there with these rumors, and then you go into the scene where I talk about marrying my cousin, what I would do with my kids if they were mentally challenged in any way. And to watch people laugh at that scene is really interesting to me, at what they laugh at and what they don't, you know, because the way it was written was from the book. There was a thing where one of the characters actually said, according to Jordan, that if his cousin were mentally challenged, he would take them to an institution. But when we were improvising, I started going to this place where Donnie was aware enough to make a joke by saying, I would take them to the woods and open the door and say, run free. And then he goes, I'm just kidding. But he goes, seriously, I would take them to an institution or whatever. As if that is the real answer, and not like, he's aware enough to make a joke about something super duper offensive. But then what he's saying, the reality of the situation is also incredibly, incredibly wrong and offensive. And so I find it so interesting to see people laugh from discomfort and just how shocking these guys are. You know, I love watching people watch this movie. I've never had a feeling like that where I watch people's faces in the audience watch what my character does and how it affects them.
Is there anything in the significantly different about what was written by Terrence and what you guys got? That was did you guys talk about it? I guess what I'm trying to say during the making of it, you talk about, should we maybe throw in more emphasis about the banality of the behavior, or should we just hold back and let people figure it out? Was there a discussion about that, kind of kicking around about what we're doing, how we're putting it together?
I think it was pretty clear that going all in, and there will be no punches held as an actor, as a writer, as a director, you know, all set from by Scorsese and what he wanted. But personally, I felt, it would be irresponsible for me to play this character and hold anything back, you know, because the whole point of showing a character like this is to show their lack of impulse control, their lack of morality, their excess. And I think if you don't go all the way with that, you're bailing on the idea of what you're doing.
The line in Money Boy, I always meant to ask you, this felt like this might have been a suggestion or an improv on your own. Would you rather be shot in the head or get shot in the stomach and bleed to death? And your response was, these are my choices?
Yeah, these are your options.
That struck me as a Jonah line.
I think is an Aaron Sorkin moment.
Okay.
I would love to take credit for it, but I think that's an Aaron Sorkin moment. I'm going to be safe and say it was probably a way better writer than me, than mine.
I wish that you would do that John Edwards film that he's been talking about. Last time I asked him, when's that going to happen?
I think he's writing Steve Jobs right now.
Yeah.
I believe that's what he's working on. Yeah, he was going to direct a John Edwards film, right?
I think that was the plan, yeah.
I would love to see that. I would love to just... Aaron has been an interesting guy.
You guys know each other?
Yeah, and we know each other through Moneyball. But there, you know, we had spoken about the Abby Hoffman project and Steve Jobs project, and different things that we've corresponded about, and just general hellos to each other. And I enjoy him a lot, and he's an interesting guy. But I had a great time working with him. I really enjoyed, obviously he's wild and guarded for a reason. But I also just think our style, I think I fit well within his writing.
What's the darker piece that follows this, follows that? What is it, before 22 or after 22? You said there's another dark piece that you're a good story?
Oh, True Story.
True Story. I don't know what you're talking about.
So that is based on a book called True Story, written by this guy, Mike Finkel, who is a New York Times writer.
Okay.
Who was let go because he had made up a lot of facts in his articles.
Okay.
He got busted on this big story in Africa he had made up.
Another one.
Huh?
Another one. I mean, there's glass.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like shattered glass. But this story is true, and it gets way crazier.
Okay.
So...
Like, did you try to justify or cover it?
Well, hang on. So, this really happened, okay?
Yep.
So, he gets busted, and he gets fired from the New York Times.
Right.
And he's miserable and goes to his cabin in Montana with his wife. His fiance, and he's there, and he's morbidly depressed. And like a day later, his phone rings, and all these papers have been calling him, you know, about getting fired and how embarrassing it is. He's not picking up. He finally picks up the phone, and it's a newspaper from Washington State. And they say, "How do you feel about the murders?" And he goes, "I don't know what you're talking about. How do you know what? How do you have to say about the murders? I don't know what you're talking about." And the reporter goes, "Well, a guy was just arrested in Mexico who's accused of killing his wife and three of the children back here in Washington, and he was posing as you in Mexico, as Mike Finkel from the New York Times."
Mm.
And this really happened, and so he goes to jail, and Mike Finkel, he's a really interesting character because, again, not a real hero, I would say, you know, because so James Franco plays this guy, Robert Longo, who is accused of killing his family, and the only person he'll talk to about the case is me. And I see this, and Mike Finkel sees this opportunistically as a chance to write a book to get his career back, because no one will hire him to do any sort of work. So he's like, this is my chance. He takes opportunity of this horrible thing to write a book to save his career. And they kind of use each other, you know? Robert Long is kind of using...
It might be from the whole of
that. It is. And that was a movie that I watched, and Primal Fear was a movie that I watched that, you know, where it's kind of, you don't know who's using who for what reason.
Right.
And they develop this really interesting kind of friendship in prison. And at the end, you don't really know who's frauded who. And it's really heavy, but it's a really interesting story. You know, a really interesting story. And so that I did right after Wolf of Wall Street.
Is that next fall or something?
I think that'll be in the fall of this upcoming year, yeah. But really interesting book and story. I don't know, I really like things. I really am heading towards things that are based on real life. You know, I found that I've been so lucky to get to work with all these people I look up to and respect, and I realized whether it's really based on a book or a true story, I mean, it doesn't have to be like some super accurate true story, but I think I had to go in all these different directions to find out, oh, the things I really, really am proud of that inspire me are things that are really, really true to life, and most of the time based on an actual true story.
There's conviction. It's not, you never sense that you're trying to be funny, that you're winking. That's my kind of humor.
Well, it all comes from character or truth, you know, like Larry Sanders Show. But I'm not saying it can't be funny. I'm saying, you know, I look at Superbad as a movie that is incredibly funny, that is about real life. You know, it's not like based on some book or anything, but it's based on Seth and Evan's life, you know. So to me, that's a true story. You understand? It's like it's grounded in some real truth and human feeling. And, you know, Larry Sanders Show is something that's something I would strive for, you know, on the comedy side, because it's like heartbreaking and real and devious and ugly and hilarious, and all the jokes come from pretty much people treating each other poorly.
Did I read that you had said recently that because of Moneyball and why you got into this role, that put you on the radar screen as far as Marty Millie?
Yeah, he wasn't aware of my work before.
Did you ever see Superman?
No, he didn't.
Really?
No, he had seen Moneyball.
Still has it, Superman?
I don't think he's seen any other films, I think.
Wow.
I showed him the trailer for 21 Jump Street, or he had seen the trailer for 21 Jump Street. Ellen Lewis, our casting director, amazing casting director who works with, was so helpful in doing this part. Showed him the trailer. He was like, hey, kid, I saw the trailer, it looks funny, but I don't think he ever saw any of the other movies. But
I so love the, I'm so on your side when you've had these altercations. Say, come on, Jonah, give us some stupid stuff. Come on, man, you know. And you say, look, man, I'm not a monkey that's going to hop here. You know, I just think I'm totally on your side of those stupid things. But, you know, they throw these bullshit questions at you when you're supposed to do this, you know.
Well, there was one circumstance in particular.
Like some red carpet thing or something.
There was one interview in particular, and the gentleman I didn't feel was respectful or nice. He didn't even know my name. And I also, at the same time, reacted in a jerk type of way. I shouldn't have reacted the way that I reacted, and I regret that. But
it was real. I felt it.
The truth of it was a bad day for me, and he wasn't a person that was being very nice, and I wasn't nice in return. So I'm at fault as much as that person is, and I take credit for that. But look, as time goes on, I think what's been interesting, at least about even this film coming out, is that people start to, I do interviews now, and people start to conduct the interviews in a way where, oh, this is a person who does all different kinds of things, and if we're talking about a specific movie, like if we're talking about a really silly movie, they should ask me really silly questions. That's fine, you know what I mean? But maybe not personal silly questions, but it's important to have a sense of humor about everything, you know? I do have a sense of humor about myself and about everything. It just is, if I was talking about Moneyball or Wolf of Wall Street, I probably wouldn't want to answer overly, really silly questions because the movies don't reflect that, really. But if I've been doing an interview for 21 Jump Street and someone asks, like, what was your high school experience like? Or what was the craziest thing that happened to you in high school? Then it is fun to answer those questions because it is a light interview for a light movie, you know?
You know, when I think of silly, my example that I give is, I really laugh at really silly, stupid stuff.
Right.
A line that, you know, Woody Allen's What's Up Tiger movie.
Mm-hmm.
There's a little map of this guy, Shepard Wong's home. So this is Shepard Wong's home. And the guy, and the detective, the lead, says, he lives in that little piece of paper. That's funny.
Right.
That's funny. I love
because it's so literal. Yeah.
But the Babysitter, that's not silly. To me, again, that's got edge. It's got bite. It's got reality.
Well, that decision was driven by David Gordon Green. You know, I love David Gordon Green. I love his films. And he's a really interesting, great guy. And I said, okay. okay, we're going to make a really broad comedy. What if we gave it to this filmmaker who has made some really interesting films in different kinds of genres? And I love all the Real Girls, and I love George Washington and Pineapple Express. And I was like, this guy's a really interesting director. And we tried to make a really, really, take a really broad premise that would be again the worst movie ever made, you know, like a funny person babysitting kids, and we tried to make a really, really edgy, dark, hilarious film with that premise. But we ended up fighting so hard with Fox to make that. It wasn't clear. We couldn't go as dark and as weird as we want, and we ended up kind of with a half and half.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Where it was half the stuff we really wanted in there and half the stuff that we had to make, you know? So, I'll take another Diet Coke, please. Well,
yes.
And I'm proud of the movie. I think it's, love David, and I love working with
movies
David.
Movies that blend, you don't exactly know what the tone is necessarily. That's the best in my book.
Right. Well, it was a great lesson for me, because it was the first movie I produced that right before I produced 21 Jump Street, and I realized you have to be incredibly crystal clear about what you're making before you go in. So no one from either side, the studio or you, has any misconception about what the other one wants or is expecting. And so it was a great lesson, because I didn't have that with The Sitter. And then with 21 Jump Street, Sony were and are amazing partners, because I said, I want to make Bad Boys meet the John Hughes movie, and it's going to be R-rated, and hopefully we'll feel emotionally like a John Hughes movie, and look ridiculously like that. And so they were like great, and we were great, and everyone was happy with the whole process, you know. And it was because everyone was up front, you know. But I learned that was my responsibility, to be completely crystal clear up front before you commit to something.
The only thing about 21 Jump Street that I learned was the chase at the end. Now I know that you have to end with something that feels like a climax. So if I were sitting there with you as a co-producer, I probably wouldn't argue strongly. But I somehow wanted more than just movement, cars, you know, I wanted something else.
The limo? Are you talking about the limo chase at the end?
Yeah.
Well, we had the Johnny Depp sequence, which was really good.
That was good.
That's all third act. So in the third act, it is the hotel sequence, which I really love, where it's Johnny Depp, and he gives the whole speech about how he tries to look cool, and just to, so people think he's cool. And then we kill him really aggressively. And then, we run out, and there's a limousine chase. But then we end up with the sequence, which is great, I think, where we shoot off Rob Riggle's genitalia. And then it's a payoff that we never knew the Miranda rights, and then we finally knew. So I guess you're right. So from the hotel to the end, we needed some exciting thing to happen, I guess.
And I get that rule, so you have to deliver that on some level.
It is, and it's you know what, when you're writing it and when you're doing it, it does feel, okay, this is something we're doing because we need some sort of excitement.
Sure.
But if we just went from the hotel to the end, it's interesting. The goal is that you can make that chase worthwhile. Now, what we put in that chase was, you see Channing learn about the elements, and he uses the elements so you can tell he's learned something in school in order to make the Molotov cocktail to blow up the other car. And, so you try and add story and character into those things. That's the idea with a movie like that. Anytime, thank you, we're doing some big dumb chase scene, which is what it is, and which is what's funny about the movie, is that they're aware of big dumb chase scenes. Try and put as much character and story as we can into it.
Are you aware of, or has there been any screenings that aren't industry people, aren't just regular folks screenings, advanced screenings?
Have I been aware of any?
Yeah, has there been any in which just regular people,
Only my friends that are in the business that I've shown the movie to. I don't know if they've screened it for people that aren't in the industry, which to me...
Which makes me want to go see it with a paying crowd.
friends who saw it were, you know, they're really critical of me.
Yeah.
Yeah, the ones that aren't in the film business and haven't learned to be fake by their trade. You know, they, you know, which is like, you know, a lot of times in the film is you don't want to tell your friend if you didn't like their film. You try and be constructive if there's room to improve it at a certain time, but you genuinely try and find the positive qualities and, you know, commend them to the work that they clearly worked hard on and be respectful. And but my friends who aren't in the film business are always incredibly honest because they haven't been trained to do that in any way, shape, or form. They just go, oh, well, I'm, you know, that was too long, or this or that, you know, and so they're very blunt, which is great because you need that kind of open criticism. But they loved Wolf. They were like, this is, you know, this is one of our favorite movies, you know. And I think what's going to be great, hopefully, is I think when it comes out to the general public, I think people are going to be excited. There's such an unapologetic rock and roll, punk rock, crazy movie with a message about excess. And I think that's going to be something that really resonates with people. I truly believe that. And I think that's going to be really helpful for our film in a lot of ways because I think the people are going to see it and make up their minds about, you know, all I know is if I wasn't in this movie, this would be the movie I'd be dying to see. I'm dying to go see it again. I've seen it 4 times. And not because of me, but because of the film.
Yeah.
It's just interesting to hear that all the films are competing are so divisive. There's not like a real consensus of the most year. But this film, it's... Yeah, excellent. Or the other half would say, oh my god, that was horrible. I hate these people. I hate this movie. And I actually saw it. I saw the screen last night, and I was waiting for it to go to the bathroom. This woman came out of the bathroom.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about? You completely missed the point.
Right.
But you think about Gravity, like, high-tech visuals, but where's the story here? You're just like, oh, that was too harsh. Old people hate it. It's just so interesting this year for some reason. It's like so many...
But that means there's good, interesting films, you know? If they are...
Screens, I guess. Like, revising people can't find them. But I really like that. There are a lot of films pushing it this year.
But that's great, don't you think? I mean, I think I'd rather have films that are polarizing because they go for it in some major way than a film that is just easily digestible to every single person. You know, sometimes there's that great film where everyone loves it, no matter how jaded you are or how old you are, how young you are. But a lot of times it's, you know, a lot of my favorite movies are movies that some people just straight up don't get. And a lot of other people's favorite movies are movies that I straight up just don't get, you know? And that's a great thing about art in general, is that you can, everyone can see it and have these different opinions about it, you know? But I agree with you. I think it is a year filled with achievements and people going for it, which is great.
Yeah.
You know?
It's also frustrating.
Yeah, but I mean, look, this art, Wolf of Wall Street, you know, Leo and I are playing incredibly unlikable people who don't do something good at the end and don't apologize at the end and don't get what's coming to them. So it's understandable how some people can just watch that and go, I don't like those people, because I don't like those people, but I understand that it's a point being made. You know, it's displaying something. And
I just think that's pretty obvious. It's frustrating. People can't see beyond what's directly in front of their face.
Well, if there weren't people like that, you wouldn't have people that you do identify with. You know? It's just, you need all different opinions. It's,
you know,
part of life, I guess.
You know? Online anywhere. Where was the actual Stratton Oakmont office located? I can't seem to find, went to the website, I read about it.
Oh, the final one?
Yeah, the biggest.
The big one?
Yeah.
It was in Long Island. It was in Long Island. I don't know the address. I can look it up.
See?
Yeah. But I mean, I have all the stuff.
You know, turns.
Actually, at my apartment, I have all the Christmas party videos and, you know, where everything was and photos of all the buildings and everything. I don't remember the address off the top of my head. But they gave us so much material. That was, like, one of the amazing things. research team. So, you know, you get binders and binders and photos and copies of sales pitches and photos of them on boats and Christmas party videos and music and everything. You know, it's like an actor's dream. You have so much material to work from, not just the book and your screenplay.
Told him he had assumed watching probably exaggerated film. I mean, the monkey is added, which was a great bit, but that was not apparently him. But he said almost everything, pretty much everything in the book, anyway, is not an exaggeration.
Yeah, but you also have a book written by Jordan Belfort. So it's like, you know, what I find most interesting about Jordan is his openness.
When he's out there, you mean?
He is so honest about things that are not necessarily flattering all the time. But that's why the way Leo betrays him. I think Leo, this is Leo's most brilliant performance, and I think he's the best actor of his generation. I just think he's so good. He's so, the way he plays Jordan is so unapologetic, and that's really what it's like to talk to him. You know, I think, did we talk about earlier about like how you would say something with remorse?
Yeah.
Yeah, we were saying about the guy killed himself anyway, or you would say something with sympathy, or, you know.
Yeah.
He just is matter of fact. Then I did this horrible thing. I don't know, but there's no, like, tonal shit. It just is said, and that's the way it was, and that's it.
Have you seen the Corn Blues documentary, Inequality for All?
No.
Basically saying that the weakening of the middle class, that's the vibrancy of the economy, a strong middle class,
yeah,
you know, purchasing power, you know, and that it's more and more tilting towards a greater and greater concentration of wealth with the top 1%. It's ultimately good for the 1%, bad for the economy in general.
Right.
Did you guys ever pick that, get philosophical with him at all, talk about the effect of the whole, or is he not the philosophical type?
You know, Jordan, there's this thing about Jordan, and I enjoy spending time with Jordan. You know, his thing is that he's charismatic, and he can, it almost feels like in the movie, it's like Jordan, the character, is selling you the movie. You know, Terry said it was very conscious that they didn't show the other side. They didn't show the people they were hurting. They didn't show that because you feel like you're like almost rooting for Jordan and Donnie the whole movie. And at the end, when things go dark, you understand that, oh, I've been tricked. I've been sold this story by this person.
Right.
And that's what I love about him. You know, the whole movie, you're like, oh, and then even Donnie, you know, my favorite thing about Donnie, like the whole arc of Donnie to me is, there's this scene where Donnie goes to visit Jordan by his pool and he's on house arrest and tells him, I'm going to take care of you. Don't worry about anything. I'm going to take care of you. And I got you. And at that moment, you go, oh, wow, Donnie has a heart. Mm-hmm. And he cares about Jordan. And then two scenes later, Jordan gives up Donnie, then decides to help Donnie out, and then Donnie flips on Jordan. It turns Jordan. It's like, at the end, they all are disloyal to each other and all don't care. So any moment you thought that there was love or humanity within them, it wasn't true. It was totally false. I'm okay, thank you.
Did you or have you not seen Bennett's film yet?
I have not, and I'm so excited, but I'm seeing him in a couple days. Thank you for posting that about the dinner that he threw me. That was really nice.
Yeah.
He sent it to me, he said, Donnie and marbled steaks.
Yeah.
It's like, it was very fitting. You know, and whenever I go to a steakhouse or any fancy restaurant now, I feel like I see Donnie here. You know, like I see him like at a table with women and other guys that look like you know, in really expensive
suits. Mickey Rooney was there? That's amazing.
It was incredible.
What kind of shape is he in? Is he looking good?
Oh, he was great. I mean, I didn't obviously out of respect didn't ask him how old he was or inquire, but he, you know, we had a full conversation and just sat and talked to him and unbelievably together and was there with his son and his son's wife and just couldn't have been more present and lovely.
But he was like, he's about 90 or something or what?
He's
88 or something like that?
I mean, he's got to be close to 90.
Approaching 90.
Approaching 90, yeah. But he is,
you know,
I was so impressed.
Did that ring a bell?
Yeah. Is that the guy from 60 Minutes?
No, that's
no,
Andy.
No, Mickey Rooney. I know Andy Rooney.
That's Andy Rooney. Mickey, the big actor, huge comedian.
Well, he was the biggest star in the world at one point.
And in the 40s?
Yeah.
Plus, amazing coonhound. Scored with Ava Gardner.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, known for his cutting a huge swath with the actors. And this is not a impressively, fairly short guy. And amazing for his, I mean, he's known for having a huge, voracious appetite and, doing pretty well.
Ben and I were sitting there and we were talking and just, like, that person there was the biggest star in the world.
Yeah.
You know, it was just
1930s, the Andy Hardy movie, that doesn't matter.
I mean, the name rings a bell.
Yeah.
You would recognize him if you saw him, definitely. But he's a super nice guy.
Yeah.
Robert Forster was there. I like Robert Forster.
Yeah, he's a good guy.
Fun guy to talk to. There used to be this diner called Silver Spoons in West Hollywood.
I went there and met him a couple of times.
And he was there every day. And when I was starting out, I would go there and write a lot. And I would talk to him.
Like
it was
that,
super nice. Yeah. Now it's like a fancier, it's like a more hip restaurant. They turn it into like a seafood joint or something. But I would see him there all the time. And so I've known him for a while. So I was really happy he came out. And,
I keep forgetting, you're a Los Angeles guy mainly, right?
Yeah, I live,
you've always,
I grew up out there, and I live over there, and I love New York, like, I live here as well, some of the time, but I think New York is the greatest place on earth to visit for a week or two. I just grew up in my family and friends from growing up in all of Los Angeles.
You know, I remember my telling you back during our Moneyball interview that I thought that there was a bit you did in Get Him to the Greek that struck me as I think that humor comes from unrestricted lifestyle. Right? In terms of being a certain madness, if you let that loose.
Out of control.
Yes. And that's there is a kind of humor. There's a bit that he does when he wakes up on the couch and he doesn't realize where he is. It's been a big night. And he doesn't really, first thing he does when he wakes up. And I was saying that Dylan did that once. The exact same. What happened?
Yeah.
Anyway, that's wildness. That's the madness type of thing.
Yeah.
You're a madman. You're not doing many. You're not. Did you stop? What? You stop certain foods. Stop drinking. What did you do? You change everything.
No, I just.
A year and a half ago.
Well, I just. I was never a madman.
I mean, everybody goes. Does that?
Yeah. Right. I just. Most people in their early 20s are not in this spotlight. You know, I turned 30 today, and I started working when I was 18. You know, so. I pretty much grew up and went through all my 20s in front of everybody. And, you know, I think it's not like I was some out of control person and now I'm like totally together. I don't know. I grow up and go day to day and I think I've mellowed out a lot. Like, I think the most interesting part of turning 30 for me, do you know what FOMO is? Yeah. fear of missing out.
Oh.
That's a term that I heard recently.
How do you spell that?
FOMO, FOMO. Fear of missing out. And so I think the biggest thing that I've come to terms with was that I think in your 20s you have, at least I did, a really big case of FOMO, where if people were going to do something, or friends of mine were going somewhere, or doing something spontaneous, even if I knew I wouldn't like the environment deep down,
yeah,
I would go do it because I didn't want to miss anything. And now...
But I have that every day of my life.
You do?
I love that I have FOMO. That's a good thing to have.
Well, it can be. It totally is. If it makes you happy to go do...
Yeah, it makes you hungry. It makes you...
Everything. Yeah, well, I think there's good degrees of it where you don't want to miss out on everything. But let's say there was an environment I knew I didn't like, I would still go out of FOMO. And now I would feel comfortable going, I'd rather stay home and watch a movie, and I don't really care if I miss anything. Nothing's going to be that crazy that I miss, you know? And so, and I'll live, and you'll live, and we'll all be friends still.
Yeah, I envy guys that didn't go through the wandering around, trying to figure out what you want to do, period. I didn't get into it like in mid-20s. You knew what you were going to do when you were 14, 15, right? I mean, you were definitely into it.
Into movies, definitely. But
but
it changes within that, though, you know?
Yeah.
Like, when I was 18, I didn't know I'd be getting to work for Martin Scorsese or Bennett or those people, or Tarantino, you know, like, or anyone, you know? If I was 14 and you told me I was going to be, I don't know, a writer on The Simpsons or something, you know? I would love that. I mean, that's a great job, an amazing, amazing job to have now, but I mean, my life just went in different directions, and what I wanted kind of changed throughout the process. And then, okay, so now I'm in movies. What kind of movies am I making? What kind of movies would I like to make in the future? And it does constantly change. Like, whereas I learned so much. Basically, when you're a young actor, you take any job that you can, no matter what. I'm an actor. They're letting me work on this. I'm going to go work on this. And I realized over the years now, not that I'm like some older, wiser guy, but the lessons I've learned thus far are, I've been lucky enough as an actor to read a script and go, I have to play that part. And no other actor in the world could play this part. I've been lucky enough to have that and then actually get to play the part. And those are the films, that was Superbad, that was Cyrus, that was Moneyball, and that was Wolf of Wall Street. And in the interim, I made a lot of other films, and films that I'm proud of, and had a great time making. But those films are the ones I mentioned, are the ones that I will live with forever and be proud of, and go, I had to play that part. I gave that every ounce of love. And then I realized I worked just to work in between. And I realize now is I shouldn't do a film unless I feel that way about that part. You know, because or else I won't be as good, or I won't be challenging myself and I won't be able to give everything I have to.
You just said something that there's a documentary about Frank Geary.
Oh yeah, I love Frank.
And he says almost exactly the same thing. He was in the business of delivering, buildings that his and designs that his employers wanted. And he reached a point where he figured, I'm not going to do what they wanted. Either I'm going to do it for me, but I'm going to feel good about it, and it'll make me feel good 50 years from now to think back. I'm just not going to be a guy who's just going to take the job and do the best I can. It's going to be what I want to do.
Right.
And that's when he became a great architect.
Yeah, and maybe I'll become a better actor because of that mentality, you know? But you have to live and learn to learn some of these lessons. But I don't want to act in the film again until I cannot not play that part. I have to do it. For whatever reason, I'm just emotionally connected to it.
You know what I thought was a lot better, more than I expected, was the David Gordon Green thing about the Paul Rudd.
Prince Avalanche.
Yeah.
I love that film.
That was pretty decent, yeah.
I thought Paul Rudd was fantastic.
It looked looked like it was going to be nothing or not enough, but it was a lot better than I expected.
I think for David Gordon Green, when he works within getting to make a small movie that is purely his own vision from his heart, I think he's unstoppable. I think he has such a beautiful style of filmmaking. And I think when anyone else gets involved with that, with him, they don't just let David go make a movie that he's making. He can't do his best, you know? He's done great work, but I think his movies are absolutely beautiful when he's just left alone to make the story he wants to tell.
I thought he was going to be Terrence Malick when I saw George Washington. Had that quality.
Right. But I think he's gone back to making smaller films, you know, that come from his heart. I think that's where, I think it took him a journey to find out what was best for him.
I really respect him because he's obviously gone in a different direction. You don't think he's going to do comedies anymore, or he's not in a comedy comedic movie?
I don't know. You got to ask David. I mean, I love David, but he works on Eastbound and Down, which is a fantastic show. I don't know if you watch the show, but I find it to be good. But he seems to have gone on this journey and found where he realized his best work's going to be.
Yeah.
I'm proud of him. I'm excited for him. Great guy.
So can I get a shot of you before we...
Yeah.
What's your best side? What do you want to do?
from the top down, or
just the back.
Back of my head, yeah. Yeah, of course, man.
All right.
Thank you so much for all your support, Jeffrey. I really mean it. It really means the world to me.
No, it's absolutely my thing.
I respect you very much, and I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
It's nice to meet
Thanks
you.
Thanks for taking the time.
It's a pleasure. Oh, are you kidding me, man?
Yeah.
It's a great way to spend my birthday.
Yeah.
I love hanging with you. All the crazy shit I've had to do the past 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Don't put that in there.